Baba, why do you think hip-hop and Chaucer, why do you think these two forms work together?
I think partially because they are the same thing for their times. They may seem different to us, but I think Chaucer to his time, you know, was fulfilling a similar role as rappers fill for our time, which is lyrical entertainment and, you know, the auditory experience of rhymes and rhythms and stories all combined together in a virtuoso way. I think that's what rappers do now, and that's what Shakespeare was, that's what Chaucer was, and that's what I see poetry was up until a certain point. Of course, that's not what we think of poetry as today anymore, and this is my whole theory in the introduction to this book. It's because print culture took over poetry, and poets ceased to think about their audience and started to think about their readership, and so they weren't so concerned about the oral expression of their words. They were more thinking about how it would affect someone's mind while they were reading it, and that changed techniques, and it changed assumptions, and it changed the content, and it turned poetry into this thing we think of it today, which is this literary culture where poets are all, you know, trying to publish the most complex, deep material they can come up with, and they're not really concerned about their audience anymore. They're not concerned about, you know, they're not concerned about entertaining people so much because they see that as, you know, common or something. I feel like poetry has become something that's a little too insulated, and hip-hop has taken it back and brought it to the people again. I mean, so has spoken word.
Poetry's become solitary, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think if a person aspires to be a poet nowadays, you know, the people they're influenced by and the people that they're speaking to are not going to be, you know, every man. Whereas rappers are trying for a more universal audience. And that doesn't mean that they can't also be complex and also have social commentary and also, you know, do all the things that literature is supposed to do. It just means that they have to at least be accountable to their audience, whereas poets have to be accountable to readerships, which have different expectations.
I guess it provokes a question as to, and I know you're not saying that if poetry had continued in the vein that Chaucer was working with an audience and live presentation, that it would sound like by poetry, I mean, you know, white European poets and poetic forms would sound like hip-hop. But I think you're saying that it would have gone in another direction than the one it has gone.
Sure, and I think it may have come to sound more similar to hip-hop than what contemporary poetry does sound like. Because, you know, I think what it is about a rapper's rhyme that makes people throw their hands up and love it, you know, I don't really feel like that is a racial thing. I think it's something that can be captured by anyone anywhere, you know, that kind of playfulness of connecting words together in a creative way. I feel like there's a lot, like culturally hip-hop came from New York and like that you can feel that in the way it's expressed everywhere around the world. But I think
how do you feel that? In other words, what makes it that way, New York to you? Like, in other words, when you say you can feel that.
Just in the slang that it uses, in the references that come in through old school rap, you know, like my perspective on hip hop is more global because I've been to all these places and hung out with rappers in England and Australia and Scotland and Prague and everywhere like that. But all these people have a common lexicon which comes back to New York. You know, everybody can tell you who Rakim is and, you know, who Kool Herc was,
Grandmaster Flash.
Yeah, it really, you know, there's this whole like pantheon of original rappers that everyone everywhere knows, and they're trying to build something new on that. So that, you know, the seeds were sowed here, and also just that kind of, create something out of nothing spirit that it came from, where, you know, we've got nothing here. We can't, you know, we can't take violin lessons, but we can plug our stuff into the lamppost and do a block party right here. You know, it's an accessible art form. You can't do ballet, but you can lay down cardboard and break dance and entertain people and, you know, just create something about with what you have in your hands right now. And that's where the creative spirit of hip hop, I think, comes from. You know, it's the ultimately most accessible art form to anybody, because all you need to do to learn how to participate in it is study what's been done and find a way to make it new.
If you see this and or understand it, why do you think most people see hip hop and Chaucer as utterly repellent to each other? In other words, why do you think most people don't see this connection that you've derived?
Well, I think it's because most people have either a superficial understanding of who Chaucer was or a superficial understanding of what hip hop is. Most people aren't close to both cultures or both, you know, forms of expression or entities. And I found myself in the unusual position of being close to both of them, and I came to understand who Chaucer was and what he was doing for his time. And most people who study medieval literature can't quote rappers and don't know about the history of hip-hop, and that's something that I've been really interested in since I was young. And it just felt like what MCs were doing and where they came from was a really similar place. But it took, you know, and that also came from me participating and being an MC myself and getting involved in, you know, the culture in Vancouver, you know, getting in battles and, you know, writing songs and ciphers and freestyling, doing all the things, the culture in Vancouver, you know, getting in battles and, you know, writing songs and ciphers and freestyling, doing all the things that MCs do, I kind of felt like the place that they were coming from was the same place that Chaucer was coming from and traditional poets have come from.
How has doing this project deepened your appreciation of and or understanding of Chaucer?
I think it's just made me feel like I imagine Chaucer must have felt. I mean, it's one thing to come up with it as an idea, but I've performed this show hundreds of times in the last few years in front of crowds. And, you know, I can see people's reaction to the humor. When I crack the jokes in The Miller's Tale and play the different characters, you know, to see people's eyes light up or to see them make a look like, talk to each other, like, I know somebody like that, or, you know, that moment of recognition. And it's not about they recognize Chaucer's characters from the 14th century. It's more like they recognize that element in people, or they recognize, you know, that character in someone they know or something, you know. So I feel like Chaucer must have had a similar experience for his time creating these stories and reciting them to his audiences. You know, the impact he could have had, the lessons he could have taught, and the reaction he would have got, I feel like I'm trying to manifest that today as well.
What would you say to those who say that this analysis of the development of language and or of poetry is Eurocentric?
Well, I would say that there's a bit of an imbalance in where we have texts from. If we're studying poetry in the 14th century, we have 90% of texts from Europe. Well, that's not true, because there's tons of stuff from China. There's you know, civilizations grew up in concert all around the world, and you know, Africa was part of that as well. But when we're studying English literature, you know, I think Eurocentricism is kind of inevitable, because the English language didn't spread around the world until a certain point, and that was a colonial enterprise on its own. But, you know, personally, my study of literature has been in the English language because I'm not multilingual. So I feel like it's kind of just, you know, work with the tools that you have. And I don't feel like that means that other parts of the world should be neglected, but those are other forms of scholarship.
And I don't mean that your study of this is Eurocentric, but even the emphasis on English literature. I mean, English is the dominant language in this country. But
and in the world.
Well, second only to Mandarin Chinese.
Well, English is the most commonly spoken as a second language.
Yes. Yes, and the most widely spoken geographically. Mm-hmm. In other words, you'll find more people speaking English in more places than you will Mandarin Chinese.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that if that's the point, Chinese doesn't rank up near it in proportion to the number of people who speak it as a first or second language.
That's true.
In other words, we're not talking here about something where someone is doing this in deference to numbers, but in deference maybe to power or to position. And there is 14th century Chinese language or 14th century, Indian Hindu. And this is not studied. It seems to the deficit of us as people.
Well, they're studied in China and they're studied in India.
You're right.
They're just not studied here. And, you know, I come from Canada, and in the United States, these are both English-speaking countries. Primarily, Canada is a bilingual country, so we do study French as well.
Right.
And French literature is well represented. But, you know, when we're studying the linguistic history of the language that we speak, then English literature is just, you know, naturally where you go back to, Shakespeare and Beowulf and everything like that. But, you know, that is really the study of a national literature that has, you know, been picked up and built on by other countries who ended up speaking the same language for colonial reasons. But I can recognize the argument that it's Eurocentric, but I don't think, you know, I don't think there's really too much we can do with that, because history has been a bit Eurocentric as well. I'm not trying to stifle any other voices, but, you know, it's just literature and history are often studied in concert like that.
You sound like you're influenced a lot by the artist Eminem. Is that correct?
I listened to a lot of Eminem, for sure, when he came out. I feel like he did new things in terms of the wordplay that he was capable of messing with, the rhyme patterns and things like that. And, you know, definitely it's been an influence, but it definitely, I wouldn't say it's been a primary influence. I feel like I've got a wide range of different rappers that I feel like I've tried to learn from, but you know, part of it, I hear this quite often, and I think part of it may be just that we're both kind of like skinny white boys. You know, we have similar, I don't know, vocal cords or manners of inflection or whatever it is, but you know, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do except keep doing what you do?
That's it.
We're going to close this out with track number 8, The Rhyme Renaissance, from your album, The Rap Canterbury Tales. And what is that about? It's a very interesting kind of, if you will, narrative about the development of language and of rhyme and even some of the things you talked about in terms of poetry.
Yeah, The Rhyme Renaissance is really about looking back at the history of language and the history of oral traditions through the lens of hip-hop. And I really feel like hip-hop is the newest form of expression in what has been a global phenomenon, which started in Africa because human civilization started in Africa. And you know, the human species started in Africa. These are kind of archaeological truths. But then that spread around the world as people colonized all around the world and diversified into every language, and every tradition had their oral traditions. And then, you know, these manuscript cultures sprung up in certain places, and writing. I feel like this, you know, it's something that's evolved over centuries. And hip hop is just the newest way that that human creativity has been plugged into this phenomenon of language expression. But it's not brand new. You know, it's something that has happened again and again historically. This is really crucial to it. A lot of people feel like hip hop is spread around the globe because of American domination of culture, just like McDonald's is spread around the globe. And some people say it's because you know, kids are obsessed with gangsterism all around the world, and you know, the idea of the gun-toting homeboy is the most alluring thing that someone around the world could think of. But I really feel like part of the reason hip-hop has been so successful is because it turns us on in a way that is instinctual, that people have an instinct towards wordplay and creative language use that hasn't been satisfied by poetry recently, because poetry has become this print culture medium that's inaccessible to most people. And when people hear hip-hop, it fires them up because they can see the creativity that's gone into this form of expression. It's storytelling. It hooks you in. It's lyrical. It's got rhymes. It's funny. And that's something that has.
You say that's instinctual. You don't think that's learned. You think that's like instinctual, like speech itself is instinctual?
I think it's evolved.
Very interesting.
I can't see why else it would be something. I mean, it is something you find in every culture. Every culture has oral storytelling traditions where they creatively use language to reiterate their cultural narratives, right? This is something that human beings have, you know, that's how we interpret the world. And it's something that before technology and printed pages and MP3 players and all that, that was something that was done as a community event, by people telling stories together to entertain each other and to help them learn. And, you know, hip-hop has become a community event in the same kind of way. And you've got your storytellers who are playing, I think, a really similar role, you know, interpreting the world for people using language creatively. And so I'm trying to reinterpret hip-hop through that historical perspective, which I haven't heard anybody else really saying before.
The book is called The Rap Canterbury Tales, and so is the CD, and they're by Baba Brinkman, who's done a very interesting thing by linking together the music of hip-hop and the lyrics, or the poetry, if you will, of Chaucer from Middle English to create something that's both new and old. And where can people learn more about you and your work?
You can download MP3s and learn about where this came from at my website, which is www.babasword.com.
And that's Baba's Word, B-A-B-A-S, Word, W-O-R-D.com, Baba's Word.
That's it. That's me.
It looks like
videos.
Baba's sword.
Yeah, it's actually a bit of a pun. It's kind of a Rorschach test. You know, some people see one, some see the other, but I really see, you know, like what's mightier, the pen or the sword. I feel like there's a kinship between them. And then you can also, if you want to actually hear tracks from my new album, Lit Hop, you can download them from the MySpace page. They'll just play right off there. It's myspace.com/Baba Brinkman. That's my name.
The new album is called Lit Hop.
Lit Hop, yeah.
As in literature hop.
Or literary hip hop. And I, you know, this is a term that's been tossed around out there, and I feel like it's kind of there's a vein of hip hop that already is lit hop. I'm just trying to create a name that actually works for it. And I feel like Talib Kweli is lit hop. Kanye West is lit hop. Aesop Rock. You know, people who try to do more with their lyrics and have them be as rich as literature is, but still entertaining and gripping for people to listen to.
The book is called The Rap Canterbury Tales, and so is the name of the CD. His name is Baba Brinkman, and what he's done is he's taken the lyrics, if you will, the poetry of Chaucer from Middle English, and he's put it together with the sound and flow of hip-hop music to create something that is new and old. And he's been our guest today on Nonfiction and at WBAI. Baba Brinkman, thank you for being our guest today on Nonfiction and WBAI.
Thanks for having me, and it's been great.
Natural History of Rap. Listen. This time we living is a rhyme renaissance, and this history lesson is 5 minutes long. And if hip-hop is bringing it, fine, let's get it on and consider it official when I finish this song. My goal is to redefine the whole history of rhyme, cause the only way to free the soul is to free the mind. And no wisdom as old as this should be confined to total mystery, so we'll just read the signs and Da Vinci codes and try to see the science in this linguistically composed pristine design. It goes deep. Suppose we could just rewind to where we first rose to our feet and left the trees behind. We'd see tribes of bipedal australopithecines trying to survive as species divide and interbreed, attending to basic needs like safe places to sleep, raising seeds, and making sure they had things to eat. So they started solving problems by evolving language genes. It probably started from the need to follow wildebeest herds, or the need to distinguish between weeds and herbs, or from mimicking screams of red and green birds. It's a chicken egg riddle. Which came first, plain speech or verse? Cause as long as there's been words, there's been awareness of relationships between words. And when rhymes connect them, new meanings emerge. See, the history of languages has been researched by linguists and traced back to a singular birth. So the ability to speak rhythmically and sing works to intrinsically link every human being on this earth. This time we living is a rhyme renaissance, and this history lesson is 5 minutes long. And if hip-hop is bringing it, fine, let's get it on and consider it official when I finish this song. But I wonder what percent of what happens is meant to happen, cause in the genesis of rap, what has to be factored in is that this chapter was invented by black men, and all human beings are descended from Africans who spread across the map in every different direction and adapted to every place under the sun. So their faces started changing as the race was run, just as every language came from the same mother tongue, since each one directly relates to another one. From the open plainsmen to the rainforest dwellers, every people needed designated storytellers to pass on their culture orally from the elders. And rhythm and repetition and rhymes and refrains allow performers to organize storylines in their brains and memorize more kinds of important signs and names and make changes based on the needs of each performance. Feats of endurance are needed to describe deeds of enormous historical importance, like the Trojan Greek War and the horse used to breach the fortress. In the aforementioned tradition of reciting, writing was a natural invention for kings to catalog things with practical intentions. And the offspring, of course, was the birth of the author, from Homer to Virgil to the immortal words of Chaucer, the father of modern verse and first formal border crosser. This time we living is a rhyme renaissance, and this history lesson is 5 minutes long. And if hip-hop is bringing it, fine, let's get it on and consider it official when I finish this song. But the birth of the author was also the birth of the ego. Celebrity seems to bring the worst out of people, especially with the invention of the printing press, which instantly made poetry so much less intimate, cause suddenly poems were mostly written to be read alone instead of written to be said aloud to crowds of listening heads. And in just a few centuries, rhyme and rhythm were dead, and 40,000 years of lyricism were watered down and exposed to careless prose on mostly modernist grounds. And poets found that the old supportive crowds were not around, but they hardly even noticed because they were published and important now. But then recorded sound started with Thomas Edison, one of the most intelligent inventions there's ever been. And ever since, a person's words could be heard across the globe, and the emergence of this rhyme renaissance was possible. But it really started off in the Bronx in the 70s, when kids with limited means produced monster melodies. High fidelity beats made their speech more compelling when ghetto teens resurrected rhymes and storytelling and used ancient wisdom as a system for rebelling. The rhythm was thrilling, swelling the competition. And millions of brilliant minds fought for the top positions. And people finally seem to be starting to sit up and listen. I'm just trying to give them a bit of a nudge with this composition. And the epilogue? Now it's been about 29 years since hip-hop first appeared and confirmed the worst fears of the powers that be. Cause now it's in every urban sphere, assaulting virgin ears. It's like a massive attack. Cause every language on this planet can be adapted to rap. It's like a gigantic amoeba that's having a snack. A generation thinking vocally, acting locally, speaking openly, and having an impact globally. This time we living is a rhyme renaissance, and this history lesson is 5 minutes long. And if hip-hop is bringing it, fine, let's get it on and consider it official when I finish this song.